My name is Joe Hine, and welcome to Inflection Points, our podcast about how leaders find a new path to growth. Today we spoke with Mark Sargent, a partner at Phoenix Equity Partners, one of the UK's leading mid-market PE investors. You'll love this one because we discuss what is private equity and why and when they choose to invest in businesses. Why has private equity traditionally avoided more creative industries, but what has more recently changed? The misconceptions of private equity and what made Karmarama such a success. From SI Partners, this is Inflection Points. My guest today is Mark Sargent, a partner at Phoenix Equity Partners. Phoenix Equity is owned and run by the partners. They are one of the most established and well-respected mid-market private equity funds. Founded in 2001, they have raised $1.7 billion of capital and made over 60 investments, working with some of the UK's most ambitious founders and entrepreneurs. They were one of the first investors to see the opportunity in marketing and digital services, putting money into Karmarama in 2011 and exiting to Accenture in 2016. One of the anchor investments for Accenture as they began the M&A march. More recently, Phoenix invested in social media agency 1,000 Heads in 2019, helping to double the business before it sold to Labellium in 2022. And Mark sat on the boards of both businesses, plus multiple other investments. Somewhat a rarity nowadays, as Mark's a lifer at Phoenix, has approaching almost two decades with the firm. His journey and the success of Phoenix are inextricably linked. Mark, welcome to Inflection Points.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So if we may start off, let's demystify PE slightly for our audience. There are a lot of questions entrepreneurs have about the topic, and I think you would be a great guest to help me answer them. But, you know, what is private equity and how does it differ from other forms of investments like venture capital or angel investing?
The short answer to your question is it's all about risk and stage, I suppose, of the development of a company. Mm. So private equity is very much supporting established growing businesses and trying to help them go faster, get right. bigger. Whereas venture is typically earlier stage. Mm-hmm. Often companies are not profitable yet and the investment going in is to help them get to that stage.
Right.
Whereas a lot of what we're doing is helping founders transition, acquiring actual shares and then yeah. helping a business really transform itself.
So over the recent times, there's been some difficulties in investment in terms of like interest rates changing, and that's been more affecting the venture capital world or the private equity world, or kind of both in together at the same time?
I think it impacts the whole market. The cost of debt,
yeah,
which is a feature across the market, has gone up.
Yeah.
We've had years of cheap money,
yeah,
basically, and that's allowed people to pay quite high prices for businesses. And ultimately, we are all, whether venture or private equity, trying to make a return on that investment,
yeah,
and calculating what we need to believe in three, yeah. four, 5 years' time to get there. So if the cost of all that money has gone up, it changes those parameters. So that's definitely had an impact on the market, and it's slowed down private equity funds' appetite to sell, certainly over the last 12 months or so.
Great. Well, we can come to that. And again, just to sort of start unpicking a bit, how does a private equity fund work? What's the cycle, if you like, for you guys?
So we and lots of other funds would look to raise a new fund every 5 years. So the typical way a private equity fund works is to invest over the course of a five-year time frame and then realize
yep.
investments effectively over a five-year time frame. So you get a 10-year life cycle mm-hmm. per fund. We are a general partner,
yep.
so we are the fund manager.
Right.
And effectively what we go and do is raise money, committed capital, from limited partners, LPs,
mm-hmm.
Who are pension funds and institutional investors.
Yes.
And they will commit pools of capital, which we aggregate together,
yep.
and that makes up a fund. And we'll close that and then look to invest it over that five-year time frame.
Got it.
So that in essence is what a private equity fund is, and we'll do that every sure. few years.
And when you raise the funds, have you physically got the money, or I mean, how does that work?
No, but it's committed.
Right.
So if we find a really interesting investment to make, getting into detail slightly, but we will issue a drawdown notice.
Right.
Those investors are obliged to send
you the money
over, And we will look to then invest it into the company.
So you're not sitting on piles of cash, heaving, gaining lots of interest.
No, I mean, that's ultimately it's their cash and they want that benefit. So exactly. There's a time value of money and they only want to deploy it when we actually need it.
Of course. You know, you joined Phoenix in 2007 from UBS. I mean, what attracted you to Phoenix?
Probably sounds cliche, but it was all about people and culture,
right?
For me, I came out of one of the big investment banks, which was brilliant. Loved my time there. But you are, and you very quickly realize, you're a very small cog in a massive machine. And actually what I realize is I love M&A. I love what we do, but I'm even more fascinated by what makes businesses tick and how you grow them. And lots of our clients at the time were private equity funds. And I was fascinated by what they were doing, particularly at this sort of mid-market end, because you get to meet real entrepreneurs, real founders, really influence the direction of a company. So A, it was what I really wanted to do, but B, I just love the people that I met at Phoenix, and it's kind of why I'm still here, almost two decades on.
And how big was the business at the time?
Very similar, actually, in terms of number of people.
Oh, really? Okay, interesting.
And fund sizes. So, I mean, I think one of the things that Phoenix has done very well, and our strategy has changed over the years, but actually we're doing the same thing for the same community of businesses. Yeah. And that sort of sticking to knitting, I guess, has meant that we can really be genuine, I suppose, and authentic when we're talking to management teams. This is what we do, rather than, you know, aspiring to be something quite different.
Yeah. And you said sort of sticking to the knitting. What is the knitting of Phoenix?
We really want, you know, our ambition is to work with really ambitious, passionate entrepreneurs and founders and management teams and help them massively transform the size and the opportunity of their businesses.
Yeah.
We often talk about bigger and better.
Yeah.
And I think the two do go hand in hand. So we exist to allow or to help that happen. And that when we sell a business and when people ask what we're proud about, or certainly what I'm proud about individually, it's about those journeys and those stories that you help people go on. So lots of the founders we meet don't know much about private equity. And I'm sure we might talk about it, have some fears or whatever it might be. A lot of it's about, how do we help overcome those fears, I suppose? How do we put the right people around the table and frankly allow a business to thrive? So it's way more than capital. There's lots of capital out there, but really why we exist is to help those founders go on that journey.
Yeah. And why would people choose you? Why would people choose Phoenix? Like you said, there's a lot of other capital. What makes you special?
You're right, there is lots of choice. And whenever I meet a new management team or a founder, I suppose were I not to be sort of selling Phoenix, I'd give this advice to everybody I ever meet, which is you're effectively, marriage is a bit strong, but you are going to spend an awful lot of time with this fund over the next 4 to 5 years. You've got to really like the people. You've got to trust them. You've got to believe that they can add some value. You've got to believe that even if you disagree, there's a way to disagree and then find agreement through it. It helps if you can go for a beer. You know, a lot of the founders I've worked with, I know their families. So lots of funds will sell all the things that they can do on top of the capital. And we Phoenix would absolutely do that. But for me, the absolute differentiator is the people. And I think what you get at Phoenix, to actually answer your question, is real authenticity. What you see is what you get. I think we're all genuine. We're all big believers in culture and people and how we allow those things to thrive, I suppose, or encourage those things to thrive. And that to me is the biggest differentiator.
Yeah, and I can absolutely see that. And you spoke there about marriage, you know, albeit perhaps a limited period of marriage, but the intensity and the commitment is very, very similar. What are sort of the characteristics that you're looking as you're going into to those kind of conversations and trying to work out if it's somebody you want to partner with going forward?
So we obviously look at lots of things. I'm sure many founders would say we're too detailed in the way we look at things. But actually, I come back to the same things that I've just said. A founder should judge a private equity firm by.
Yeah.
We are looking for things like track record and has the business got the right people or the right tools or IP or products or whatever it might be to deliver on a plan.
Yeah.
But ultimately, we're looking at, can we work with those people?
Yeah.
Are they aligned with us on where we're trying to get to?
Yeah.
Do we have a clear roadmap on how we're going to do it? Are they influenceable?
Yeah.
I suppose. We won't know all the answers, but we've generally seen similar problems that many other businesses that a business is going to face. So there's a sort of, are they open to advice? Are they open to help?
And
that's what we're trying to get under the skin of what really drives people. And does that fit with, I suppose, how we're going to work?
I totally understand that as a concept. One of my previous guests was an ex-footballer. Mm-hmm. And then he's gone on to be very, very successful in business. And I asked him about what are the traits that make footballers, allow footballers to be successful. And he said that they're coachable, mm-hmm. that they're able to listen, they're able to adapt and absorb and kind of understand advice and take that forward. And I guess there's a lot of sort of parallels here with what you're saying.
Absolutely. And I'm sure if I brought in a number of our founders and sat them down, I think they would all point to that. And they don't always know when they go into this journey.
Yeah.
Because we are often the first institutional capital into a business.
Yeah.
It's quite a big moment for these founders and they don't quite know how it's going to go. But I think all would sit there at the end and say, actually, if you're prepared to be coached, if you're coach is probably the wrong word, but to listen, to learn, to double down where you've got real conviction, but trust that actually me or someone else around the board table has got a different perspective and it's based on something. You know, the combination of all that, you know, it's the classic team thing. You put them all together. The sum of the parts need to be greater than the individual. And that is often what we're trying to achieve.
Yeah. Fascinating. And then just talk about your journey a bit. Cause like you say, you've been here for 20 years. What have been some of the inflection points that you've undergone as you've gone through the partnership?
Yeah. I mean, it's in a way it passes very quickly. I think in our industry, you sort of link your inflection points, I suppose, to certain deals and or certain investments, certain people that I've met along the way, and then sort of individual kind of working your way up through different experience levels. I think when you start out as a mid-20 something, you think you know everything, and you go to board meetings and you're like, this is brilliant. I'm sat around with all these old people who kind of, you know, and I can tell them what to do. And actually, it's nothing like that at all. And you very quickly realize that life is not like a textbook.
Yeah.
You know, dealing with issues that companies have or changes in market environments. So the first few years, I wasn't actually doing anything to do with media. Mm. I was doing a lot of business services, quite a bit of oil and gas stuff. And we obviously went through the global financial crisis, big oil price declines. So, I mean, one of the businesses I was working with at the time went through a huge amount of change. Mm. And that was a massive learning ground for me. I had to deal with banks. I had to deal with changes to the management team. We sold a bit of the business. So there's all sorts of stuff. It was quite fast sort of learning ground. So I sort of took that as quite a big inflection point where you realize actually there's way more to businesses than simply the plan says X, so we're going to do X and Y. Probably the next big one is one you've already mentioned, which was Karmarama. And that was a business that we invested in 2011, quite an ambitious plan, which involved putting together very early two similar sized businesses. And that's a business that I can't remember the exact year, but I ended up sitting on the board on my own of eventually. Right. And that's another sort of real inflection point where you're suddenly not the more junior person of the two of us that usually sit on a board. I'm suddenly there with the CEO and we're slightly, not quite master of our own destiny, but you sort of lose, I guess, the comfort blanket. So that was another massive learning ground for me. And as you've already pointed out, it was a successful exit in the end. And actually I was getting calls for years afterwards, how do we sell to Accenture? It became like the big thing. So actually to be one of the early ones on that journey was brilliant.
If we can keep talking about Karmarama, because it's something that our firms worked on together, what drew you to the sector? Because it hasn't had a lot of private equity investment, or certainly was one that was incredibly wary. I mean, it's a very creative, business that, kind of we wouldn't naturally have assumed that it would take investment. I mean, what got you there and them there, if you like?
I'm going to find this hard to talk about without acting like I'm trying to sound like a genius in hindsight, which is absolutely not the case. But our style of investing is very thematic. And what I mean by that is we're looking for sectors, niches, markets, I suppose, that are undergoing disruption and change, where there are long-term drivers of growth that are different from just what the government or the economy is doing. And I think our view of marketing services at the time was, A, you had this massive wave of what people were just calling digital at the time coming on, and which has since become digital and data, obviously. But so, A, you had this sort of shift going on from above the line to below the line, and how we were dealing with social media, which is all reasonably new back in the day, and digital marketing generally. So A, there was that, and B, there was this very clear view from the people in the sector that the big guys at the time, the big agency groups, the WPPs and so forth, were building phenomenally successful businesses, but they were very, been built by M&A and quite siloed.
Yep.
In how they were doing things. And our perspective, talking to brands and customers of these businesses, was people wanted a more joined up offering. They needed their TV to look the same as their digital offering or whatever it might be. So our view was there was an opportunity in a very entrepreneurial sector where there's lots of young, growing businesses that are probably all a bit subscale on their own, to put a few of these businesses together and build something that was much more customer centric rather than individual discipline focused. And I suppose finally, to answer your question, we had a view, and this is the bit that's going to make me sound like a genius in hindsight, that there would be more effectively investors or buyers into the sector as this market evolved, as it became more digitized, as data and digital became more important. And I'm not going to say we predicted Accenture would be looking to invest, but as this sort of merging, I suppose, of the CMO and the CTO and the CIO sort of functions, some of the consulting businesses and the IT businesses, as they're looking to get access to the boardroom, would look to invest into this sector. We don't get all those things right every time, but ultimately it's our job to try and think about how we might exit our investments at some point in time. And we got that one right. And obviously that market has just carried on and on and on. It's pretty sort of standard now in terms of potential acquirers for these types of businesses.
I think what's fascinating about Accenture is they're still about 20% of the market for digital media businesses, but you don't hear about it anymore because it's just part of the fabric rather than being something special. And it was very special at the time. But what was it like? I mean, you are an investor, you're kind of rooted in numbers and logic and risk averse. And then you enter this environment, which was incredibly creative. You had people like David Bugadini, who, has gone on to be a very successful artist. And what was it like entering that creative culture, and what did you learn from your time?
I will just pick up on one thing you've just said there. We're not completely numbers focused, and we're not completely risk averse either. We are, I think I said it earlier, we're very focused on people.
Yeah.
And their ability to, I suppose, transform a business with the right help and support around them. So yeah, yes, it sort of comes back to numbers, but I think it's one of those misconceptions about our industry is that all we're focused on is the numbers and the, you know, at the end of the month board meeting, all we care about what sort of last month looked like. It's not. It's about where we're going and how we're going to get there, and have we got the right people to do it. So
But I'd still say it's quite an opposite end of the spectrum.
But you're right. This was an industry that private equity had generally avoided, and the reason being absolutely candid is, back to my comments earlier on influencing people, creatives are quite hard to influence.
Yeah.
Because they're obsessed by the creative output.
Yeah.
What's made them phenomenally successful. The creative output isn't always the optimal financial output.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you are absolutely spot on. Whilst I'd love to say we're not 100% numbers focused, we do come back to, are we growing value?
Yeah.
And a creative would say there's value in the creative output. My experience in Karmarama is there often was, but it was value to the individual rather than to the, it was their reputation rather than to the company. So that was definitely a learning experience. It took time. Patience, and a compromise probably on how you balance those two things.
Yeah.
And I think it works both ways. All those people that were also, I suppose, in it to also make a bit of money. And therefore needed to see that their equity was growing. So I suppose we were able to influence by showing them that, like, if we do A, B, and C, and we get to here, this is what it might be worth to you. Doesn't mean we have to completely sacrifice, you know, anything creative over here, but little things like over servicing clients.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think Ben Bulbul, the CEO, would mind me saying it was rife at the time, and everybody was slightly scared to go and ask the client to pay for it.
Yeah.
So we went on a long journey on that, on, you know, whether we should have timesheets or not have timesheets, and how you manage whether pricing with customers, which is a sort of dirty word in this sector, but ultimately it's getting paid for the value that you're trying to provide. And I think we found a happy medium at Karmarama that sort of allowed the business to thrive creatively, but profitably and sustainably. And you know, ultimately that sort of, you know, led to the outcome that we got to.
History tells us the answer. And then, you know, it's kind of served you well. 1,000 Heads was another sort of great sort of success story for you guys. And can you see private equity continuing to invest in that sector?
Yes. And I think there's obviously been a much, I was going to call it a wave of investment into the sector over the last few years. And I think that is a combination of reasons. One, I think I'm definitely not trying to downplay creativity, but a lot of these businesses in a digital context have slightly different business models, revenue models. Clients are often stickier. At 1,000 Heads, we often talked about reoccurring revenue. Rather than so being so sort of project or lumpy. And I suppose in a digital world, a lot of it is test something, see what data you get out of it, refine it, do it again. So it's a much more continuous cycle, I suppose, which is much easier for people like us to get our heads around, because then we can say, right, at the start of the year, we've got this client base, we've got this level of, I suppose, resources, and I can see that this level of revenue or this level of work is going to be there. So then it's a case of, well, how do we layer on top and what do we need to do that? What other services might we provide? Have we got some capacity to invest in? a new product or a new service or whatever might be, that's much easier than sitting there on the 1st of January and just hoping that a bunch of project work comes in. So I think this world has gone, or sorry, this sector has gone down that road. And certainly when I talked to Mike Davison of Thousand Heads, I think when we rethought about how the business was positioned, he very much believed that Thousand Heads was the next stage of digital transformation, which is the sort of phrase that lots of your listeners will be very familiar with. He was talking about social transformation. So it's all very well to change all your systems and all your, the way in which you sort of manage your business internally and to an extent externally. The next stage is how you're engaging with your consumers in a consistent way, or your customers, which is in a social context, at least what he was talking about. And I just think all of that is, you know, the IT services world, the digital transformation world has been a hotbed of private equity activity for ages. And it's because I think it's a more recurring, predictable market. And I think all we're layering on here is a bit of creativity, which is essential and was essential to Thousand Heads.
And I think certainly there's some motions in the market that the science has taken over a little bit too much, and creativity is has risen in its importance to create some differentiation. So it's perhaps getting the balance right.
It is, and then you come back to the people around the table, the executive management team. Mike, again, at 1,000 Heads, I don't think would mind me saying, he's an absolute data geek. He'd done a lot of the programming of some of their internal tools himself in the past, and he was obsessed with data and less margin, but more about where work was coming in and utilization and whether people were stretched and all that sort of stuff. But there was a very strong counterweight in the business around creativity and output. Being famous for the work that they were doing. And that worked because you had that sort of equal level of respect and balance in the team. And I think when we diligenced the business on the way in and spoke to customers, which is something, by the way, every marketing services business fears, but actually in this case, we presented it back to Mike and said, look, this is what your customers are saying about you. And there were comments in there like the perfect blend of science and creativity and
interesting.
Actually, this feedback was kind of transformational for the management team to say, actually, this is what's working, this is what's not. So it wasn't just a diligence exercise; it actually added a lot of value as well.
And you touched on, so you know, due diligence is a big part of kind of going in, and you know, you have a responsibility to your limited partners. Mm-hmm. They give you some money to invest, and so you have to make sure you've done your due diligence on the business. And in our experience, the way private equity approaches things, or a financial investor does, is different to a strategic investor who might know and understand the industry and kind of have more of a touch and a feel for it, rather than somebody that hasn't got that same experience and isn't living and breathing it in the same way. So there is a lot more due diligence. You know, can you talk a bit about the processes that you go through to get yourself comfortable and ultimately get your LPs comfortable about making the investment you're going to make?
Yeah. Well, I think I'll start at the end of that. Our LPs trust Phoenix to make those decisions. So that bit is actually not that complicated.
Yeah.
The biggest bit is, how do we decide as an investment committee, which is another term you'll have heard, which is ultimately the body at Phoenix that collectively decides whether we make an investment or don't make an investment, should proceed or not. And you're right, there are, whilst we will try and be experts in subsectors and niches, we can't know it as well as the people that are already in it. And also, I suppose, we are starting, we're usually looking at businesses as a standalone proposition rather than, well, even if something went slightly wrong, I can rely on some synergies or some, you know, customer sort of cross-sell or whatever it might be. So we have to be a bit more forensic in that sense. In terms of processes, every private equity fund will be different. We Phoenix, try to decide what are the, right up front, what are the four or five things that are sort of make or break.
Yeah.
And there'll be things like, you know, what do the customers really think about this,
yep,
this business? Is the business really making the amount of money that,
yeah,
either the company or the corporate finance advisor is suggesting it makes? I.e., does the valuation make sense?
Yeah.
Can we really get underneath the growth plan and believe the levers, yeah, that need to be pulled or the things that need to happen to get there? And yes, diligence tends to expand outside of that. But ultimately, what we're trying to get to as a firm is, can we get comfort on those four or five things?
Yeah.
And we will go through, and again, every fund will be different, a series of what we call workshops, effectively.
Yeah.
To review those four or five things and the work we're doing, and to check that everybody's comfortable on the way. So what you shouldn't ever get with Phoenix is a grand reveal at the end, yeah, of a process,
yeah,
that says, you know, sorry, Joe, actually, we're not going to make this investment. Yeah. You'd know before then.
Yeah.
We might think about whether the terms of the investment or something needs, yeah, to change, but we try and make that those decisions on the sort of make or break. Are we really up for this earlier in the process?
No, makes a lot of sense. And I touched on there just about your LPs, and if I may, I'd like to go back and talk a bit about fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
At one level, perhaps a bit of a dark art for those that aren't kind of familiar with it. But, you know, not wanting you to breach any trade secrets, but can you walk us through kind of what the typical process for you guys to raise funds is, and you know, kind of what are the key stages and how long does it take?
In a way, it's very similar to selling a business.
Right.
So we have a track record and we have a group of partners and,
yeah,
and people at Phoenix. And ultimately we are selling,
yeah,
I suppose, our ability to manage an LP's funds and deliver them a certain return, or hopefully in excess of a certain return. And they will be weighing that up against other funds,
yeah,
performance and,
yeah,
people and strategy and all those sorts of things. So in terms of how long does a fundraising take, that's an impossible question. I think the average is something like 18 months.
But, right, okay.
But it's, for some it'll be a lot quicker because their existing investors will,
sure,
simply come back and say, yes, I'll come in for an extra, what I did last time, plus an extra 20%. And if they all do it, great. The harder bit is going out to new investors who,
yeah,
don't know you,
yeah,
and talking them through why we are going to be really good stewards, I suppose, of their capital, why we can deliver great returns, why we can do it the right way or in a strategy that suits what they're looking to do. Where are you going to go and invest it? How are you going to originate investments according to your chosen strategy? So, you know, if I came back to, you know, if one of our sort of areas of focus was marketing and digital,
yeah,
services, what are you going to go and do to find these businesses? Are you going to wait for SI partners to just call,
yeah,
you up, which is not the Phoenix model, but it will be for others? Or are you going to go out and try and actually meet,
yeah,
businesses and get to know them over 2 or 3 years? And can you identify those,
yeah,
now? So,
yeah,
that we've got some comfort. So there's always a big focus on where you're going to originate and deploy the funds, and have you got a track record of doing that?
Yeah.
So how did you originate the ones in your fund?
So it really does shape your thesis and what you go and what you're allowed to do and how you play with their money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because once they make that commitment, as I said earlier, that's committed capital. So
yeah,
for 5 years, whatever they've committed, yeah, that will get put in.
Yeah. Interesting. And as a fund, you make a lot of sort of first money investments.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is where an entrepreneur is taking a partner in, or a financial partner in, for the first time. Many founders worry about losing control of their company. Is that a realistic fear? What's the reality?
It's a fear I've listened to lots of founders,
yeah,
relate to us as well, often in hindsight of how it's actually worked out versus, mm, what they thought on the way in. It's not a fear that they should have. I absolutely understand why they should. But if you get that relationship thing,
yeah,
right, that I talked about earlier, we don't sit around board tables and have formal votes with hands up and all that,
yeah,
sort of stuff. We're working quite hand in glove.
Yeah.
And I think there's something that lots of founders, and I actually think a lot of the corporate finance community forget at times as well, is we can't realize our investment without a management team, without a founder. You know, we've got to be aligned on where we're going, how we're going to get there, and ultimately how Phoenix is going to exit its investment. Yeah. So you've got to find a way of working together, and it's got to rely on trust and it's got to rely on being open. So it's not a case of, well, I think you go and do that, so you must go and do it because I own 66% of the shares and you don't anymore. It's much more around influence and, and do the collective group believe that the course of action is the right one to take? If it ever does become that, right, you need to go and do this because we've said, I think the relationship's probably broken down. So the actual percentage of equity and who gets what at the end, it's way less relevant to, I think, success of our investments than that relationship that I've just talked about.
Very interesting. And what advice would you give to an entrepreneur looking to partner with private equity or thinking about taking on private equity?
Be very focused on culture and the people you're going to be working with. It depends what you want. There are private equity funds out there that suit every, I suppose, style of company investment. So we Phoenix are quite hands-on. We want to be involved. We're interested. We have a relatively small portfolio. So each of the partners at Phoenix will typically sit on two, max three boards. They all matter. We all invest in them individually. So you will get quite a lot of, I suppose, attention and interest. If you don't like the person you're going to be working with, find somebody else. If there'll be other funds out there that have massive portfolios. And frankly, if you're doing well, they'll just leave you alone. So maybe that's what you want. There'll be others out there, and I don't want to badge it particularly, but there'll be ones out there that have a playbook, and they'll have a series of, I suppose, execs on their book that are effectively going to come in and, and effectively not take over, but tell you what to do. You might want that. You know, there might be a sort of, that might be a, a sort of rich journey. So lots of the UK mid-market work in a more culture-driven, people-driven way, but there are pools of capital out there for, But so be clear on what you want. And then I go back to the marriage conversation we had earlier. You've got to like the person, you've got to trust them, you've got to think they can bring something to you.
And what should an entrepreneur be thinking about 2 years out? You know, if they think this is the direction of travel they want to go in, how should they be thinking about their business, or what are important characteristics of a business that you would welcome in a conversation?
I would advise them, albeit a slightly self-interested answer, to start to get to know a few funds in advance. So one of my, I suppose, criticisms of the corporate finance community is you run brilliant processes, but it's quite hard to really get to know somebody in a sort of formal way. So one of the tests, you know, one of the things that we look for is, you know, has a team done what they said they were going to do a year, 2 years out from an actual investment? And I think they could look, you know, an entrepreneur can look the other way and say, as a private equity fund behaving with other investments, talk to other founders that funds that you like have invested in. So that they would be the sort of at that level. In terms of the company performance, if you're going to tell people like us that you're going to take a business that's doing X of revenue to X times five, and you're going to go and do these three things to go and do it, well, I either have some track record that can point to why it's going to happen, or have some people around the table that can do it. And I think one of the things that gets missed is this, well, often we will hear, okay, great, we're in this fragmented market, we're going to acquire these 5 to 10 companies. Well, have you ever made an acquisition before? Do you know what it entails? How are you going to integrate it? And you'll quite often get sort of rabbit in headlight type looks back. Well, everyone else does it should be easy. So I think the more that you can demonstrate growth, profitable growth.
Yeah.
And you've got the tools that you need to deliver the growth plan. They're the main things.
Got it. It's very clear. Can we talk about exits?
Yeah.
How do you know when the right time is to exit an investment?
There is no perfect answer to that, because every firm is different. Sometimes it is because you get chased.
Yeah.
And dare I say it, the number that people chasing you gets higher and higher, and there comes a point where management team, founder, I'll sort of sit around the table and say, actually, this makes some sense.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's a consolidating market and you either want to be consolidated or you want to be the consolidator. And there will become a natural point, I suppose, where a private equity fund, based on their own fundraising cycle or what they've deployed into a company, they won't want to put more into a business because they won't get a return on that incremental bit. So that often will drive a management team saying, well, if you're not going to support that, then I need to go and find somebody that is. It's just always a collective decision. I suppose the one thing that we do, and I think I suspect most private equity firms would do the same, is exit's always on the agenda.
Yeah.
You don't talk about it every month, but there's generally a, look, this is what we're heading towards. We always talked about a 3-year plan or a 4-year plan, and we're going to get to X million pounds of revenue and profit. Yeah. Where are we on that journey? What have we got to believe? And when is the timing right? Because what you can't do is say, oh, actually, you know, time's about right. Let's sell next, you know, in 3 months' time. And you've done none of the thinking or the prep, or the, if there's a succession maybe required, say the founder wants to start transitioning up to a non-exec role or something. You need to think about these things quite a long time in advance. So that is one thing that we will want on the agenda regularly, so that we're always, I suppose, exit ready.
Yeah. One thing we found, and we did a piece of research recently, was that a lot of the investments in marketing digital services, a lot of our world, actually a lot of the exits that have happened have gone to another private equity fund. Mm-hmm. Is that, can you see that happening more and more, given that there's more and more private equity funds out there, and are strategic exits becoming less likely?
I don't think they're becoming less likely. So both the investments we've talked about today have gone to strategics or private equity backed strategics.
Yes.
In the case of Labellium. I think it's just a case of there's a lot of capital out there in terms of private equity and a scarcity of really good businesses.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we see quite a lot at our end of the market is if you can take a business and be north of £10 million of profit, $10 million of profit, the pool of people looking for businesses that are of that sort of size, and the scarcity of businesses in that area, mean that you can quite often get a frenzy, but a lot of people very interested.
Yeah.
And private equity firms are set up to make investments and move quickly. And often trade parties aren't. Some of them are very good at it. We've sold businesses to WPP in the past, and they've moved brilliantly quickly. But other strategics have taken a long time, various committees and boards and approvals that are needed. And I think that's where private equity have a huge advantage. It's just a day job.
Just increases risk in the process, and time kills deals, as we kind of know.
And you see management teams and entrepreneurs, it's tiring doing a deal.
Yeah.
And it's not really what they want to be doing. They want to be running a business. Yeah, yeah. So
interesting.
I think speed, deliverability and conviction are things that private equity can bring.
Yeah, absolutely. Very interesting. One final question, and sort of look back on, look forward a little bit, and you know, where do you see the private equity market going? I mean, in my view, it's just more and more money is coming into the industry. More and more deals are, once they're on a private equity track, continue down a private equity track, but yet IPOs are not happening at the moment and aren't seen very favorably and haven't for a while. Are people going to need to change their view on how they get returns for money, or you know, what's the future of private equity look like?
I'm obviously in the sector and in the industry, and therefore a massive supporter of it. And I think it brings massive benefits to the economy and to businesses that probably don't get talked about enough. But I do think it's going to carry on.
Yeah.
Going, if there are businesses out there now that are allowing private and retail investors access into private equity funds. So it's off, you know, historically it's been this sort of secretive world. I think it's opening up a bit. There's more and more capital, I think, coming in. Mm. I think the returns continue to be very strong, even in a higher interest rate environment. And I think private equity does a massive amount of good, particularly at this mid-market end, where it's about helping businesses massively transform, whether that's get into the States or get into Europe or build a new product. And there are so many stories out there that don't get talked about as much about strategics killing a business because they don't understand the culture or they don't understand what made it special. It's all about synergy or whatever. It gets lost in a massive corporate. You don't get that in private equity because each one matters. We've got to make everyone work. Mm. So I just think it's a wonderfully exciting industry. And it's, for the reasons you've already talked about, only going one way, really.
Yeah. It's fascinating. We could talk much longer, but we really must draw it to a close. So, Mark, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Enjoyed it. Thank you ever so much.
Cheers.
Inflection Points is a production of SI Partners, the M&A advisor and growth consultancy to creative and technology businesses. Subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. My name is Joe Hine, and you've been listening to Inflection Points.